Welcome to Editing Aloud, and it's been a dramatic week for audit firm KPMG, with our sister newspaper, The Times, reporting darkness descends on KPMG after an investigation of its own resulted in 8 senior people resigning or stepping down from their posts at the weekend, and clients starting to vote with their feet, and SARS, the Revenue Service, weighing in to twist the knife. Ron, what is the story behind this, and how bad is it for KPMG?
This could be a collapse of one of the big four, right? Because if you look at it, I mean, their biggest clients are the banking guys. I guess if one of them pulls out, they of the top 5 banks, and 4 of them, they join auditors there. If one of them decides to end the relationship and they follow suit, it actually is potential collapse of an auditing firm. And these are firms built on the whole business case is about trust, integrity, and so on. So if they start questioning it, then basically, I was listening to someone this morning on the radio talking about even the lotto. Can we trust the lotto? Because KPMG is the auditor there, right? So it all kicks into fundamentally the trust towards the institution. And it's funny enough, KPMG South is the same one that bought Arthur Andersen when they collapsed after Enron. So quite a story. So I can imagine the people inside that building who were from Arthur Andersen days now looking at 10 years odd, 20, almost 15 years later, looking at perhaps a collapse of KPMG. I still think it's on the cards within the next maybe a month, 2 months on.
And what are the consequences, say, for the banking sector if the firm were to collapse?
I mean, speaking to one of the big banks, Investec and so on, they need two big auditing firms on their books at all times. So if KPMG falls apart, that means they have a choice between only 3, right? So the price, there will be that knock-on effect in terms of the banking sector with regards to the cost of having just 3 big auditing firms. But in my book, I don't know if there's any saving of KPMG for, especially now with SARS came out. So it's so entwined in South Africa, in the ugly politics of South Africa right now. How does KPMG get its face out of the muck, which is our politics at the moment?
Sikonathi, you would have looked at the KPMG report which they put out over the weekend, which is KPMG International probing the local firm and finding it wanting in terms of quality control judgment altogether. What has enough action been taken, and what should the international firm and the local firm be doing more than they should already have been done?
Not enough has been done, absolutely. The fact that those guys resigned does not even begin to address the matter. It's a good start, but they need to go back and say, what exactly did we do wrong? And admit to that and start the cleanup there. Strike everybody off the role of auditors and the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, and everyone must meet the correct punishment. They've abused the trust and integrity of the profession that Ron spoke about, the trust of the nation. Whole economies rely on auditors because, exactly like Ron has just pointed out, banks rely on auditors, and therefore all economies rely on the auditing profession. And these guys need one to lay criminal charges against anyone inside KPMG. Just letting them off go is not enough. They need to lay criminal charges against their own colleagues and see who did what, admit to what they have done, rather than a vague statement just nearly apologizes but doesn't.
Tim, has enough been done?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I can see that there is a a potential collapse scenario that's not for the international firm, but for the local franchise. But I do think they've really given it a solid thump. I mean, I don't think they. It's not satisfying to me as a journalist. Sitting outside of the organization, but. It's difficult to know what more they could have done. There are things that they could have done. So what they've done is that they have withdrawn the crucial report that they did, which they into SARS, and specifically denied that retracted their conclusion that Pravin Gordhan knew about the rogue units and all of those sorts of things, but then on the other hand, they were the Gupta's accountants for what was it, 15 years. In 15 years, you should know your clients a bit better. I mean, I do feel a bit for the thousands of other people within KPMG who've been doing very respectable auditing work for years and years and years. And I do think, you know, as a general rule, there is a fantastic mismatch, you know, a morality mismatch between what's happened in government and what's happened in the private sector. I just don't think that you can miss the two. You know, the private sector organizations are dropping like flies. People, senior people are, you know, being scooped and going into kind of retirement. In government, nothing. Not one person. Not one person has been charged. Not one person has been questioned. No one has been asked what happened to the, you know, to the billion that they, you know, that they sort of siphoned out of Transnet and so on. So, you know, I mean, it's true that, you know, it's good that they are cleaning house. I'd like to see government cleaning house too. Thank you very much.
And Jim, do you think enough house has been cleaned?
No, it's not. If KPMG must pay with the collapse of KPMG in South Africa would be a fitting end to this. To this kind of behavior. They have been helping, let's take the Gupta family, for 15 years. How crude could you be? You're stealing 30 or 500 million rands that goes to a place in the Free State that is almost a desert. There's absolutely nothing there, 90% unemployment rate, and you chuck off the money to Dubai, and you fly over as a KPMG executive to Dubai to advise these guys how to open accounts, how to avoid tax in South Africa, how to evade everything, and then how to bring back the money to pay for your wedding. And that's just the start. I repeat, criminal charges, in addition to those people being fired, need to be laid, and KPMG needs to audit itself properly, investigate, hire an independent investigator, and publish the whole report and say, this is what we've done wrong, that will have been cleaning up, but we do need to see someone in orange overalls. Now, that is the price you have to pay for being in the market, and for unfortunately, we cannot choose the prosecutor to prosecute the people that KPMG helped.
What's helpful here with the private sector here is that all these companies are internationally linked. So all the private sector companies that have owned up and done something are not South African based domicile companies. You think it's KPMG? The reason why they reacted to this is because of head office. I mean, of the headquarters HQ. Same with Bell Passenger. The same with McKinsey. There will be some reaction. I'm sure in the next couple of weeks or months about McKinsey will have some sort of reaction because they've been in the Financial Times. And so on. So the names are being dragged in the mud internationally, and that's been our the only way we could ever charge the Guptas in my book is because of international. If someone internationally is affected by the Gupta largesse in this country, so in terms of here politically, only after December, it's almost a perfect place for someone to come in here, the new ANC guy, and clean house. And that's the only time we'll see someone pay the cost for all this corruption. I don't think. Beyond December, if December ends up with a bad candidate, we'll never see anything.
But Ron, sticking with KPMG for a minute, do you think that the KPMG International has been visible enough? Because they seem pretty absent to me. Yeah. And have they done enough? I mean, do we have a path forward out of this mess from the company?
They weren't visible until FT started focusing on KPMG internationally. And it finding up, even internationally, they've been in the UK, and so I was looking at some research there, they've been getting some fines for some dodgy behavior as well in the UK and in the US. But so KPMG as a global institution, there's been question marks around it. But as soon as they got the heat internationally, that's when suddenly came out and did something with regards to this thing that they were hoping, I'm pretty sure they're hoping would blow away over time.
Actually, Tim, the Financial Times columnist John Gapper is talking this week about KPMG and McKinsey. Tell us a bit about that column.
Well, yes, I mean, it was interesting because, you know, it's funny how these things creep up on these organizations and then, they claim, it's fine, nothing's going to happen, it's fine, we're not going to do anything, it's fine, we're completely legal, it's fine, bang, gone. You know what I mean? I cannot believe that a company like McKinsey that has, you know, that prides itself on having the smartest, fastest, the cleverest people in the room by a country mile, can't see that their South African operation has been charging, you know, has been massively, massively overcharging Eskom, for an absolutely, totally transparent reason. And the transparent reason is because they were told to by Transnet. You only get our account if you give Trillion the black empowerment portion of the account. And they said, well, okay, well then this is going to cost you zillions. and or in fact trillions, as it turns out. Honestly, this is not making this up. You know, so now so up to now, McKinsey has tried to stonewall. You know, they tried to say we did nothing illegal. We're doing good work there down there in South Africa, and you know, it's just not going to stick. And yeah. and you know, they have too many international brand issues that they have to deal with, and they have too many international links, and when the international world starts the sort of commentariat, if you call it that, starts turning against you, then you start losing accounts. Mm. And then as soon as you start losing accounts all over the world, then all of a sudden the South African operation becomes completely dispensable. Yeah. So, you know, John Gapper was just making the point that, we now have a kind of narrative which is, you know, traversed over a whole bunch of organizations. And he said he was sort of intrigued to see how, you know, McKinsey were going to try and deal with it. Mm-hmm. And he noted, the completely obvious, which is what they've done so far is not enough.
Speaking of organizations under pressure, Sikonathi, tell me about the Public Investment Corporation and the efforts to oust the CEO, Dan Machila. What is that about?
Let's start by this disclosure. I hold absolutely no water for Daniel Machila, and I'm not protesting to his innocence on anything. But Malusi Gigaba, anything he touches has collapsed under the weight of corruption. Go all the way back. Mm-hmm. And the same, the modus operandi is the same. He becomes a minister, he replaces key members of the board, audit committee, chief investment officer or chief financial officer, and the board tender committee, and that's what he does, investment and finance committee on the board. It's the same script, Transnet, Denel, Eskom, when he was at DPE. Now all of those are bankrupt. They are except for Transnet. They are looking for cash. There's only one place that still has cash. It's the one that he's at now, and that's the PIC. Again, same thing. He came in, appointed deputy chairman, a caller named Kwanazi, and 2 weeks later, Daniel Machila is in trouble. He's being accused of XYZ. And I repeat again, I do not know if Daniel Machila did or did not do what he's being accused of. What we have now is the PIC with 1.9 trillion rand that can bail out Telkom with SAA via Telkom without thinking. It can just sign a check for Eskom, 50 billion rand, Daniel, 3 billion rand. That's what is wanted. Daniel Machila has been accused of nepotism and dishing out cash to his alleged girlfriend of 20, they said 21 million rand. It turns out the money that was actually awarded to that company is 5 million rand. And the board met on Friday last week, and they wanted to deal with him, and they didn't even give him a chance to respond to the allegations, and they just resolved, this is a whistleblowing exercise, and therefore we'll treat it like that, which means we'll suspend this person and start investigating. When he came in to be told about the decision, he correctly protested that, but you guys have not even asked me what's going on here. Then he proceeded and presented the record of decision, everything that's been made, and then the board was like, oh, so we got it wrong. And they said, okay, we believe you. It's fine, carry on. We have full confidence in your integrity.
But we're going to come back to this one after the break. It needs some discussion. Yeah. Welcome back to Editing Aloud, and we are in the middle of a hot discussion about the Public Investment Corporation. Ron, this is pensioners' money.
Yeah, it is.
That everyone's playing around with. I mean, should we not all be very concerned about what's going on there?
I think politicians are, you know, how simple-minded they are. They think, like, the PIC is sitting with 1.9 trillion rand, and it's liquid, it's there, there's money to throw around. But this is money, it's like maybe 3% is given to money market, whatever. So there's a mandate to how this money is. So whatever, if you're taking out money, 10 billion odd for SAA, they've got to have to sell something, like, so draw down and have to balance it out. So I think what they're doing now is, like, I think they understand that. So by removing Dan Machila and then going into the audit committee and getting into all into the investment communities, that's when the systems in place in PIC, which work very well with regards to, I mean, SAA comes for a loan, PIC has to go through a thorough process before they give out anything, right? So what they're doing is just shortcutting all this and putting their own people in there, so this money, so there'll be a sell down of Telkom, whatever the case may be, to fund SAA. But it's very worrying when this is basically they're hijacking the entire PIC, the whole process,
this
the whole
is the
governance.
Pension funds,
yes,
of civil service.
Exactly, it's the whole governance of the PIC, which they are basically coming and say, okay, fine, the problem is we have to hijack this entire system. But I'm sure even if Dan was playing politics and he was, fine, I'll fund SAA, and the CEO is in on it. The point is, he has a whole committee that he has to convince to actually go ahead with the funding, which generally doesn't work out, but PIC sits there and says, should we really fund SAA? By all their own mandate, by all their own targets, they shouldn't touch SAA. And by PIC's own rules, they would not touch SAA. So this is where the government is deciding with under Malusi, the only way we're going to fix PISA and make Dudu happy and in turn the president is literally going within the governance structures of the PIC and breaking them all. It isn't just an attack on Dan. Dan is the first, suspension of him, bringing in the other board members, looking at the audit committee, looking at the entire investment community, the committees within PIC, and that's where you'll see the rot. And suddenly some crazy decisions will happen, regardless of what the government employs, the GEPF, right? Yeah. Mm. So this is exactly what you can see unfolding, and it's Malusi just having his way. You can see this is what's stopping you from funding SA, and whatever is ESCOM next is the same committee. So this is pretty scary in my book.
Tim, what happens if the pension funds of government employees, because it's 2 million or 1.9 million government employees and government pensioners whose money is at risk here. What happens if that money is compromised?
Well, this is the problem. You get then into kind of the actuarial estimates of what the pension fund will require as and you have to ask this very difficult question about whether or not it's overfunded or underfunded. That's why they have these absolutely rigorous systems. Mm. That's why this is not a loaning operation. This is not a it can't even be really a developmental organization. It has a developmental sort of mandate, and it has a sort of it does devote a certain amount to kind of developmental mandate, but this is not the development bank. Mm. This is this is the repository of the wealth.
Mm.
Yeah, this is the repository, and they are required by legislation, also by the organisation. By the way, it's not so easy with the PIC to sort of go in there and get them to dish out 10 billion rand to SAA, because they haven't like other fund managers, they have an investment criteria. Mm. And they have clients that they have to that they have immediate clients who that they have to answer to. Just to complete Sika story, because this meeting happens, the statement comes out. It's the most curious thing on the planet, because the statement comes out saying that we have total confidence in Dan Machila's integrity, but we're still going to investigate.
Exactly.
And so basically my reading of what happened was that the vast majority of the board of the PIC was appointed by Pravin Gordhan and by previous finance ministers. The two people who were appointed by Malusi Gigaba, they had an argument. So obviously the majority won, but the majority had to toss them a little bone.
We can't find anything on him, but we'll keep looking.
But we'll keep looking, until we find something. Yeah.
And on the 29th of September, they are coming back on a special board meeting to table whatever they have found in that investigation. Okay. In the man, they have already decided they have full confidence in his integrity and ability. But I'll leave you with this one. When Malusi Gigaba became finance public enterprise minister in May 2009, ESCOM, which reported to Public Enterprises Minister, had 18.5 billion rand in cash at the end of financial 2009 March. That was enough to run without any liquidity issues. When he left in 2014, ESCOM was begging you and I for cash to pay salaries. The money had been stolen. I don't know by whom. I did not say it's Malusi. Mm-hmm. The money had been stolen. You and I capitalized ESCOM 83 billion rand, 23 billion rand of that in cash in 2015, after Malusi had touched it. The same story goes for Denel. SAA is gone. Malusi, when he came in there, it was functioning. Now, Daniel Machila came in 2003 to the PIC as chief risk officer. It had 377 billion rands in asset. Today, it's got 1.9 trillion rands in assets. Mm-hmm. Choose who to believe. The least said about Sifiso Buthelezi is the better. Think about Sifuambo at Prasa. They are still trying to recover 4 billion rand.
I'm going to move on to the private sector because I don't think I can bear any more about the public sector. Not that the news from Sasol is actually that good. Tim, Sasol this morning saying that it turns out that their BEE scheme in Zalo has yielded absolutely nothing for the BEE shareholders.
I mean, it's obviously not a big surprise because, you know, when they introduced the scheme, the oil price was, you know, $100 a barrel or thereabouts, and now it's half that. So obviously the share price of Sasol is a function of the oil market. So, you know, and the whole scheme was premised on the idea that the Sasol share price would increase sort of more or less at the same rate it had increased the previous 5 years. Well, it didn't. It went down.
The oil price isn't going back to $100 again.
No, precisely. Yeah. So, you know, Sasol was sitting with an enormous problem. So what they've done, and also they, just by the way, they also compounded the problem because they borrowed money at a fixed interest rate. To underpin this the BEE deal, and you know, the interest rates went down, but they still had to pay the interest rates, the fixed interest rates. So all in all, it was a bit of a disaster. So anyway, Sasol are now trying to kind of make good. They've introduced a new scheme. The old scheme members will be able to, you know, graduate onto the new scheme, even though the old members got nothing. It's extremely expensive, about 20 billion rand, I think, if I've got it right. And Sasol's share price, and it's going to cost them, and they're going to fund it themselves. So that's going to affect the profitability of Sasol by about, we reckon, about 5%. So surprise, surprise, the share price went down 5%.
The question, Ron, is what does this tell us? Is this a reflection generally on the way in which a lot of companies have gone around about funding and structuring BEE deals, where they are so dependent on market factors which are out of their control that, in fact, the chances that they transfer real value are quite slim, and therefore, why do they carry on doing them this way?
I mean, it's all early BEE deals were funded on the basis of a rising share price, right? And I think within this 10-year period of this Inzalo BEE deal, there was a point where these black investors were in the money, but they couldn't get out, right? Because you're locked in. So you wait out and pray for this 10 years. So imagine if they were free to get out at that point where they're in the money and like, geez, we can get out here. Maybe we have to rethink business, hence the issue of once empowered, always empowered. It needs to really be gone back and discussed. So when we do the BEE, I mean, I was always, I think I'm changing my viewpoint a bit about it. Maybe this is the only way to move forward, right? Once empowered, always empowered, because once you do the deal, I'm the
You mean lock them in forever?
No, don't lock them
don't
in, right?
Don't lock them in at all. Let them cash in their shares.
Let me buy into your company, right?
And hope they invested in something else.
When I mean the money, let it be my choice. Let me make the money. Let me get out there, and then... Then we
you
have to think.
Keep your points.
And you keep your point. We have to really look at that hard, because this is the point, right? This is a clear case where 10 years later, these guys waited, and they were in the money. There were points where they were in the money when the oil price was over $100 and so on, and they were in the money, and they could have really, like, they cashed out and taken that wealth created and, I don't know, built something else, right? But they had to wait 10 years, they were locked in, and they come out 10 years, it's nothing. Now there we have Sasol having to redo it, and they, depressingly, it's another 10-year lock-in period, and only on the South African businesses, which there hasn't been much capex invested really here compared to what's happened in the US and so on. So you're locking in black investors in SA.
In the non-growing part of the business.
To make sure. Yeah. And we to guarantee them at least 10% at the end of a 10-year period. It's all this points to me that we have to really sit down and make a hard decision in terms of transformation in this country, whether this once empowered, always empowered thing is the only way to
and
go
even
forward.
Whether these equity, the money, these right? very structured equity deals are in fact including more black people than we had before, whether we shouldn't have a more thorough rethink, Sekonati. I mean, do you think this could prompt such a thing?
Hilary, the major thing here is that for anyone to buy a business, a stake in a business, you have to have the manifest. If you don't have the money, as we don't have the money as black people to buy these stakes, so you have to borrow the money from somewhere. The bankers and the lawyers have made their money out of this. The people that put in their money 10 years ago did not receive a dividend, got no capital growth, and will get nothing. Now the money is being taken from Sasol's investors to compensate for the loss of 10 years. How do we start transforming the economy? You cannot transform any economy by just selling a stake in a business team has been running forever, and you cut Ron in by 5%. What we need to do is exactly what the National Party did back then: empower the whole nation. Yes, it empowered then the Afrikaner nation. That kind of empowerment, skills, people getting there, doing the real job, running the companies and growing from the bottom. If you just hope you will impose people at the top by giving them 10 shares in that business and even that holding thumbs that things will work, it's never going
but
to
were,
work.
But they were champions, Afrikaans champions, right? They always were. So as much as you're saying empower everyone, you can't be this everyone like
broaden
as much. They were Afrikaans champions.
At the
they
biggest were. Equalizer. The biggest equalizer is education, the skills. Let people do the job. If you make me the chief executive of Eskom next week, I will run the thing down. If you give me 25% stake in Eskom tomorrow, I don't have the money to pay for it. But if you give me a proper engineering
Hold on
skill,
a second, I said,
and we start from the bottom, we move from there. We start our businesses, procurement, the government buys and does not kill businesses by refusing to pay them on time. That's where that's the real empowerment, where it starts. Small businesses being able to do business, and that's how black people get to
you need
to make the money to buy the shares.
You need champions. You need champions of empowerment. Like, okay, maybe the pool we chose initially, three was it? Tokyo, Patrice, and the third one.
And even
Cyril, right? We chose a few, but so we need to broaden the pool. However, when you broaden this pool, I think these guys almost. Maybe they forget why they got the stakes in the first place. And when they build these empires, what are you actually fundamentally supposed to be doing when you build it? And accept that, like, Patrice Motsepe is made by empowerment. And accept that, and in doing so, you must know that you have to contribute to the transformation of the economy. Maybe, I agree, the pool
get
was more.
Get people in there to do the real job, to work.
So you need champions. The whole idea of everyone must help broad. I think the problem with empowerment initially was we decided, okay, we have three people, it's bad, let's broaden this thing to huge a community trust of a million black people and give them a stake in a company, which they have, literally, they don't do anything. So they just sit there and wait 10 years and do nothing. They can't do anything to change the
mechanism,
the workings of
Sasol. That's the problem.
That's the problem. So the whole broadening thing, it's like, okay, well, what's this, right? So
we have time for this week. Join us again next week as we change the world and hopefully make an attempt to change South Africa too.